Good morning. My name is Pradeep Taneja, and I'm from the School of Social and Political Sciences, a fellow and friendly school to Asia Institute. It is my honor and privilege today to introduce our first keynote speaker of the day and for the conference. And I'll talk about him in a minute. But I thought before we do that, I will tell you a little anecdote about leadership, because Professor Lee Chung is an expert on leadership, and he'll be talking about it later, both during and after the conference. It's an anecdote about Deng Xiaoping's meeting with a former American president. And of course, there are many versions of this anecdote. I have one version. And the story is that when President Ronald Reagan met with Deng Xiaoping in 1984 during his visit to Beijing, Deng Xiaoping said that he would welcome help from China's friends in China's full modernization program. President Reagan said, "No problem. We have lots of China experts in America, in American universities and think tank, and we will organize to send some good China experts to you." Deng Xiaoping very politely but firmly said to President Reagan, "Thank you, but no thank you, because we have over a billion China experts in China. So what we really need is experts in various fields who can help us with our full modernization program." Now, of course, as China has grown and grown and grown over the past 30 years, we have no shortage of China experts in Australia, in America, and in the West generally. Now everyone seems to be a China expert. But today, we have a genuine item. We have Professor Lee Chung, who has flown directly from Washington to address this conference. Professor Lee Chung is Director of Research and a Senior Fellow at the John L. Thornton China Center in the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution in Washington. The Brookings Institution, of course, needs no introduction. I'm sure you're all familiar with the work that Brookings Institution does in enhancing our understanding, not just of China, but of the world and international relations and public policy. Professor Lee is also William R. Keenan Professor of Government at Hamilton College and a director of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. I don't want to read his long biography here. You will have a chance to hear him firsthand, and therefore you will learn more about his expertise. Suffice it to say that he is the author or the editor of numerous articles and books. One of his first books that I read is China's Leaders, the New Generation, and that's why I talked about his particular expertise in China's leadership. He's also written or edited a number of other books, and there is no time here to talk about them all, but one of his books that I've just finished reading, an edited volume, is China's Changing Political Landscape, Prospects for Democracy. He's also frequently interviewed by both American and international media, or if there is a difference between American and international, we seem to be dominated by American media. But he's been interviewed by CNN, BBC, Voice of America, NewsHour, with Jim Lehrer, and many other programs of repute. Dr. Lee has also advised a wide range of government, education, research, business, and not-for-profit organizations on their work in China. He's a director of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, a trustee of the Institute of Current World Affairs, a member of the Academic Advisory Group of the Congressional U.S.-China Working Group, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force on U.S. Policy toward China, a director and a member of Committee of 100, and a member of the U.S. National Committee of the Council for Security Cooperation in the Asia-Pacific. So please join me in welcoming Professor Lee Chung.
Thank you, Pradeep, for that overly generous introduction. I wish my mother were here. She will believe every word he said. Well, I'm honored to speak to you this morning. First, I want to applaud the Asia Institute for your outstanding work in the field of China studies, especially for organizing this world-class conference on the 60th anniversary of the founding of the PRC. Now, I believe that your institute represents a profound sense of forward-looking in Australian studies for Asia, represents the University of Melbourne's great tradition of interdisciplinary research, and represents an enlightened pursuit of international dialogue. This is what I call three represents, borrowing the famous line of Jiang Zemin, three represents. Now, I particularly want to applaud you for devoting the theme of the conference on China's transformations and the challenges. It seems clearer today than any time before that the world is in the midst of a major geopolitical and economic shift, or power shift. China, the country known for economic backwardness and international isolation, has been transformed within three decades into the world's foremost frontier of rapid economic development. This is a shift that is perhaps comparable to the rise of Europe in the 17th century and the rise of America in the later 19th and early 20th century. My assignment for the next 30 minutes is to talk about China's political future, the PRC beyond 60. As all of us know, analyzing the Chinese politics or predicting China's future is a not easy job. As the old story goes, ask five China experts about China's future, and you will get five different answers, six if one of them went to Harvard. I apologize those in the room who went to Harvard. Now, it is fair to say that China's ongoing transformation is far too often misunderstood in the outside world. Let me share with you a political joke recently spread in the Chinese internet. The state leaders of five UN Security Council members are each driving cars. They all enter the intersection. US President Obama turned on his left turn signal and turns left. Prime Minister Gordon Brown of UK does exactly the same. You know, what else he can do? His foreign policy always follows the US. However, President of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, does not want to follow President Obama. Instead, he turns on his right turn signal and turns right. The Russian leader, or more precisely, Russian Prime Minister Putin, does the same. Now, whose turn? I don't mean WHO, but I mean HU, Hu Jintao's turn. On his cell phone, he calls Deng Xiaoping in heaven, or in hell, if you don't like him. He asks Deng, two leaders have turned right, two have turned left. What should I do? Deng replies, turn on your right turn signal, but turn left. We have entered an era characterized by many contradictory phenomena and confusing signals. This is a time when wisdom and knowledge and visions are especially important. An understanding of this emerging power, including its internal contradictions, is essential for the international community, especially for other Asian Pacific countries, such as Australia. Such knowledge will help us formulate better policy options. If our vision is narrow, our options will be inadequate. If our views are distorted, so too will be our policies. Now, a recent report on China by the New York-based U.S. Council on Foreign Relations Task Force, in which I serve as a member, observed that China is a paradox of numerous contrasts. For example, modern and ancient, dynamic and stagnant, homogeneous and diverse, strong and weak, rich and poor, communist and capitalist, innovative and imitative, bureaucratic and efficient, passive and aggressive, repressive and free-willing. The greatest paradox in China, in my view, relates to its future, which is a paradox of hope and fear. Like any country, China's future can have multiple possibilities. For analytical reason or analytical clarity, one can outline three major scenarios. First, prolonged chaos caused by various triggering factors. Second, a resilient authoritarian China that will maintain one-party monopoly of power. And third, the emergence of democratic China. Let me briefly outline the first two scenarios and explain why I think they may not be credible. I will then elaborate on what I believe the most likely scenario for China's future. Now, first, the most pessimistic view. Some analysts believe that the many deep-rooted problems in China may trigger intense social, political, and economic crises that undermine the stability of the PRC. These problems include economic disparity, rampant official corruption, environment degradation, resources scarcity, unemployment pressure, the lack of a social safety net, tensions between the central and local governments, ethnic frictions in Xinjiang and Tibet, and the absence of belief or value system, the absence of ideology or belief system. You know, I'm sure that the distinguished panelists in the next 2 days will talk about each and every of these issues. Now, each of these factors, or more likely, a combination of these occurrences, can lead to the prolonged chaos and perhaps even causing the collapse of the regime, as the famous book by Gordon Zhang, The Collapse of China, illustrated. Now, these problems are real, and one cannot eliminate this very pessimistic scenario. Yet, pessimistic assessments of China have repeatedly been proved wrong. Let me give you one example. Only a few years ago, many Western analysts believed that China's accession to the WTO would inevitably cause major upheaval to its state-owned enterprises, and especially to its commercial banks. This cynical view was understandable, because in 1998, about 10 years ago, bad bank loans accounted for 40% of the capital of China's state-owned and commercial banks. In 2008, last year, however, the percentage of the bad loans was reduced to 2 to 3%. Most interestingly, early this year, of the top 10 banks in the world in terms of market capitalization, the richest banks in the world, four were Chinese banks, including number one, number two, and number three. I just gave a briefing for the HSBC, which was ranked number four. I just congratulated them to make the list as number four. This is such an irony, you know, within the past decade, the drastic change. Now, the second scenario, resilient authoritarian China. Some other analysts believe that the current top Chinese leaders will do, or have already done, more than any of their predecessors to draw political attention to many, and perhaps all, of the country's pressing environment, economic, and socio-political challenges. Some new developmental strategies recently made by the Chinese leaders may contribute to the continuing growth of the Chinese economy in the next decade and beyond. A more sustainable economic development and a more equal distribution of resources and wealth in the country will give the Chinese Communist Party more political capital and therefore more legitimacy for its rule. According to some scholars, such as Andrew Nathan, Professor Andrew Nathan at Columbia University, an authoritarian, stable, and prosperous China can be a credible political alternative. In their view, the future of China can be best characterized as a resilient authoritarian system. My reservation with this scenario is simple. If the Chinese political system is really resilient, it will not remain as it is, and it will inevitably lead to something profoundly different. Now, the most likely scenario for China in the middle-term future, in my view, is neither decay nor resilient authoritarianism, but a transition to democracy. I believe that some important economic, political, demographic, and technological trends at the present have the potential to transform China into a democratic system within the next 10 to 15 years. You know, I'm a minority, not many people argue that way, but you can see in 10 to 15 years whether my prediction is right or wrong. Now, Chinese democracy will almost certainly have its own unique features. However, institutional checks and balances, political choice expressed through elections, constitutionalism, an independent judiciary system, the freedom of media, the civil liberties are the essential components of any democracy. And I expect they will develop inside China as well. Now, let me briefly highlight five major trends in the country and explain how they will contribute to a democratic China. The first trend is the urbanization and rapid growth of the middle class. In the next two or three decades, about 300 to 400 million Chinese are expected to move from the countryside to urban areas. This resettlement will represent the largest and the fastest urbanization drive in human history. This earth-shaking urban development will surely be accompanied by an unprecedented and rapid growth in the size of the Chinese middle class. 10 to 15 years ago, if you ask any China expert about the Chinese middle class, most likely you will be told that there was no such a thing called Chinese middle class. There was only a small number of rich people and an overwhelming majority of poor people. But now, if you go to visit any coastal cities in China, you will see so many people live like members of middle class, consume like middle class, and think like middle class, and they are middle class. Now, a recent report by McKinsey estimates that by 2025, China's middle class will consist of about 520 million people. With such a phenomenal demographical transformation, China's political landscape will be changed forever. Now, some people said the middle class is very much, you know, like the government wants stability. But the question is, for how long they will develop their confidence about to deal with the political challenges. So in 5 to 10 years, their mentality could be quite different. Now, the second major trend is the telecommunication and technology revolution. This ongoing revolution is changing the way in which information and ideas are disseminated within the world's most populous country. China has a penetration rate of almost 50 mobile phones per 100 people, about 50% of the population own mobile phones. 20 years ago, there was no mobile phone network in the country, and the penetration rate of fixed phones was only 0.6% per 100 people. Meanwhile, China's subscribers of the internet are equal to the number of the entire population of the United States. With such unprecedented telecommunication penetration, no government can effectively control over the flow of information. Now, this relates to a third trend in China, the ongoing commercialization of the media. I grew up in China during the Cultural Revolution. At that time, the whole country only had a couple of TV stations, a few radio stations, and a handful of newspapers. In the middle 1970s, most people in China believed that the official media outlets, such as People's Daily, contained only lies. And I remember my late father always, you know, said repeatedly that everything in the newspapers are lies, except the date of the week. And even the weather forecasts were manipulated so that they would not be in line with the political needs of the regime. You cannot say that Mao's birthday will be raining. Today, things are quite different. There are over 2,000 newspapers, more than 9,000 magazines, about 300 radio stations, and 350 TV stations in the country. They, of course, do not all tell the same stories. Of course, otherwise no one will subscribe to different networks. Corruption, lack of government accountability, and industrial and coal mining incidents have been among the most frequent headlines in the country in recent years. Now, the fourth major trend in the Chinese society is the rise of the civil society groups, NGOs, and lawyers. There are some 220,000 registered NGOs in the country, including 6,000 foreign NGOs. A decade ago, such figures would have been unimaginable. During the past decade, the number of the registered lawyers and law school students has also increased dramatically. When President Bill Clinton visited China in 1998, in the Shanghai Library, he said to the Chinese, "The United States has too many lawyers, and China has too many engineers. Let's trade. Now, for now, China does not need to import lawyers. They can produce their own. For example, the number of enrolled students at the law school of Beijing University in 2004, the total number equaled the total number of law school students trained at the university for the past 50 years. One single year produced the same number of the past 50 years. And in China's 620 law schools and law departments every year produce 100,000 law school students. The growth rate is faster than the United States, for better or worse. Now, an important new phenomenon in China today is that many Chinese lawyers and legal professions devote their careers to protecting the interests of vulnerable, what they call the vulnerable social groups. A new Chinese name, the Lawyers for Human Rights Protection, was recently created to describe this emerging group. Lawyers will become an even more important political force in the years to come. Some will continue to work outside the political system to challenge abuse of power, while other activists or active lawyers may themselves become political leaders. Now, this leads me to the fifth or the final trend, which I believe that it will contribute to a democratic China, that is dynamics in the Chinese leadership over the past decade. What happened in the positive development, not only in society, as I mentioned, the four development, but also within the system in the China's political leadership. Now, for the first time in the history of the PRC, the ruling party is no longer led principally by a strong man, such as Mao or Deng, but instead consists of two informal and almost equally powerful competing political coalitions. These two groups can be identified as the populist coalition, led by President Hu Jintao and Premier Wen Jiabao, and the other side is the elitist coalition, led by the National People's Congress, the head of the National People's Congress, Wu Bangguo, and the Vice President of China, Xi Jinping. Top Chinese leaders have begun using the term inner party democracy to describe the idea that the party should institutionalize checks and balances within its leadership. Now, these two coalitions represent two different socioeconomic classes and different geographical regions. For example, the elitist group represents the interests of the coastal region. I told my American audience, probably we call them China's blue states, while the populist coalition often voiced the concerns of the inland region, China's red states. The elitist coalition consists of princelings, the children of high-ranking officials, the Shanghai Mafia or Shanghai Gang, entrepreneurs, and the sea turtles. Sea turtles refer to foreign educated retainees. We probably have a lot of sea turtles here, you know, because the pronunciation of foreign educated retainees in Chinese is similar to sea turtles. It's identical to sea turtles. While the populist coalition consists of the Chinese Communist Youth League officials, which is Hu Jintao's power base. And they often claim that they represent the interests of farmers, migrant workers, and urban poor. Now, these two coalitions have contrast policy initiatives and priorities. The elitist coalition emphasizes GDP growth and market incentive, while the populist coalition advocates social justice and social cohesion. I call these new dynamics a one-party, two-factions formula, borrowing Deng Xiaoping's famous line, one country, two systems. Now, I always criticize this may be too simplistic. I know it is too simplistic, but just like the concept in Western politics, like in American politics, we call them liberals and conservatives. It's also simplification, but it's really very helpful to help us to understand otherwise very complicated political landscape. Now, these two camps occupy an equal number of seats in China's most important leadership bodies. For example, in the Standing Committee of the Politburo, the highest decision-making body in the country, there are two so-called fifth generation of leaders. They are Vice President Xi Jinping, an elitist, and Executive Vice Premier Li Keqiang, a populist. Actually, I will give a talk at the ANU tomorrow, give detailed analysis of this division the equally powerful two factions. In the 25 members of Politburo, there are altogether six leaders belong to so-called fifth generation, three for each. Now, despite the tensions in the leadership, these two camps understand that the importance of cooperation at a time of economic crisis and social political challenges. Let me make it clear that at the present, this bipartisanship is neither legitimate nor transparent. Although if you ask a taxi driver in Beijing or some other major cities, they will tell you which leader belongs to which faction, usually 95% or 99% accuracy. Now, this inner party bipartisanship will not remain stagnant. Its dynamic nature will probably inevitably make political lobbying somewhat more transparent, factional politics more legitimate, and elections more genuine and acceptable at the highest level of political power. If so, it is not difficult to imagine that the Chinese Communist Party will split along the lines of an elitist coalition and a populist coalition after 10 to 15 more years of this inner party bipartisanship. In my view, largely because of the incremental nature of this institutional development, this split can be achieved in a non-violent way. The election and the competition within the CCP may extend to general election in the country, and if this happens, the eventual result of inner party democracy will be the transformation of the country into a constitutional democracy. Now, I would like to end my discussion of China's future as a paradox of hope and fear with one quote and one anecdote. The quote is by Sir Francis Bacon. He said, I quote, "Hope is good breakfast, but it is a poor supper." I'm optimistic at this point because on the remarkable progresses made in China over the past over the recent decade, I believe that these progresses are generally in line with the values and interests of the Western world. We should not fear China's success, fear its failure. Peace and prosperity in our lifetime depends on whether China is treated as and acts like a solution or problem. In virtually every important area in world affairs today, we need China to play a crucial and constructive role, ranging from North Korea to Pakistan, from energy security to environmental protection, from climate change to public health care, from anti-terrorism to peaceful use of outer space. China's peaceful transition to democracy is the best hope, not only for the Chinese, but also for the outside world. Now, here's my anecdote, which was actually first told by Song Defu, former Party Secretary of Fu Jian. He passed away a few years ago. He was a very close friend of Hu Jintao. He first said that anecdote on a different situation. Two men, let's call them Mr. Xi and Mr. Li, are traveling together in a dense forest. When they stopped to set up a camp, they suddenly see a tiger racing towards them. Mr. Xi takes the time to put on his running shoes. Mr. Li laughs and asks, "What's the use of wearing those running shoes? Can you run faster than the tiger?" "No, I'm not faster than tiger," Mr. Xi replies, "but I want to run faster than you." Now, at the time of rapid economic change in the PRC, any political leader and coalition perhaps should learn how to run faster than the other. Thank you very much.